our finger on the passage in the New Testament that shows that what the prophet said happened just like he said it was going to. Fulfilled messianic prophecies. Sometimes the statement in the prophets does not just jump out at you as being messianic, but then when we go to the New Testament and we see that it references that Old Testament passage as one that has been fulfilled in connection with the coming of Jesus, then we know that it was a messianic prophecy. Messianic meaning Messiah, an adjective, right? A messianic prophecy. Scott, would you word? I have my notation here at the deliverer, which is the third one from the bottom here on the first page of our handout, which is referenced to Isaiah chapter 59 and verse 20. And a redeemer will come to Zion, and to those who turn from transgression in Jacob, declares the Lord. Like I said, just a casual reading of this would not necessarily send your antenna into orbit saying, ooh, yes, this is pointing to the Messiah. But if we look at Romans chapter 11, and wouldn't you know, the person that asked about this is not here tonight. It always seems to work out that way. You can almost set your watch by it. Verses 26, 27 of Romans chapter 11. We'll start at the back. That seems to work good. So I'll start with Ken Hanvey. Would you read that, please?
So all Israel will be saved, as it is written, the deliverer will come out of Zion, and he will turn away ungodliness from Jacob. For this is my covenant with them, when I take away their sins.
A deliverer. The passage we read in Isaiah 59 in the New American Standard said redeemer. That's what a redeemer did. He delivered people that were in captivity. Now, the first phrase of Romans 11:26 is the one that you're usually going to run into problems when you start talking to somebody that is of a premillennial persuasion. You know, last Sunday, I spent both lessons dealing with Matthew chapter 24, which I had this passage in mind because it fits in with that subject. Excuse me, in the mind of the premillennialist who says that Jesus is going to come back to the earth. He's going to be on the earth for 1,000 years, reigning as a king. And one of the arguments that is made to support that proposition is that if you look at Matthew chapter 24, then you see expressions like the end and end of the world and other terminology that, if you ignore the context, sort of sounds like maybe it has to do with the end of time. And in connection with that teaching, that is millennial teaching, they say one of the things that has to be done is that Israel has to be, the Jews of all over the world, they have to go back to Jerusalem or to that land, and that they're all going to be saved. All Israel, because they're God's chosen people, they're all going to be saved. And this is the citation that is usually brought up. And so all Israel shall be saved. Even as it is written, there shall come out of Zion a deliverer. But that's taking the verse completely out of context, which is what generates false teaching and misunderstanding. The argument that, or the question that is being dealt with by the apostle here in this section of Romans, has to do with his, and of course this is really kind of, we have to remember it's about what the book of Romans is addressing, and that is the Judaizing teachers who were saying that the main thing is to keep the law of Moses. But so Paul shows from the outset that the gospel is God's plan, not that old law. That was never, ever intended to be the means by which a person could be saved. In fact, no person was ever saved by keeping the law. Now, that throws people a curveball because they say, well, why in the world did he give it to them? Why was that first covenant given if it wasn't for their spiritual welfare so that they could go to heaven? Good question. What's the answer? Actually, there's more than one answer.
The law was intended to teach them in righteousness, to instruct them in the ways of God, to educate them about God, and also to lead them to Christ.
All right. I would add to that in Romans 3, verse 20, through the law comes the knowledge of sin, which is just the flip side of righteousness. That's what you said. It made man aware of the fact that there was a standard, God's standard of righteousness, and it pointed out that if you didn't attain to that level of righteousness, which would be perfection, then you were falling short, which is what Romans 3:23 says, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. So it made man aware of the fact that he needed something beside a law that spelled out, do this, do this, do this, don't do this, do this, do this. Because what is the only way that a person can be justified, that is, right in the sight of God, by a law system? Perfect law keeping. Exactly. And that's what Paul argues in Romans and he argues in Galatians. In Galatians chapter 2, Paul said in verse 16, not because by the works of the law shall no flesh be justified. So it was never, and the book of Hebrews deals with this exhaustively, it was never God's intention that the law, the covenant, the first covenant, the law of Moses, the law given at Sinai, and all the other synonymous terms that refer to the old covenant, it was never the purpose of that law to make forgiveness available to people. While we're in maybe you're still there, in Galatians chapter 3, verse 24, Galatians chapter 3, verse 24, Paul said that the law has become our schoolmaster. By the way, the hour here is the Jew. It isn't my schoolmaster, and it's not your schoolmaster. It was the Jew's schoolmaster. The law has become our schoolmaster to bring us unto Christ. That is, bring us to the point where we realize that our feeble attempt at law-keeping is falling short of God's glorious standard. Therefore, what we need is the second or new covenant. That's what Jeremiah 31 is about. I will make a new covenant, not like the first covenant, Jeremiah 31, 31 and following. And then Hebrew writer quotes that in Hebrews chapter 8. Now, what's going on in Romans chapter 11 now is that the Jew just cannot get this through his head. That God would give him a law, that God would separate the Jews in this little group of people. Of course, we know probably about 3 million of them came out of Egypt, but anyway. That he would set them apart from the rest of the world, do all of the things that he did for them throughout the course of their 1,500 years of history, and then say, adios. Now, that's what the Jew that Paul's writing to, the Jewish mind that Paul's addressing in Romans is, that's what their take is. That, well, you know, God did all this for us, and then you're telling us, you, Paul, are telling us that we need the gospel, that the law's not it. Now, look at Romans chapter 11, verse 1. I really didn't know that I was going to be teaching in Romans tonight, but it just kind of took us there. I say then, did God cast off his people? Literally, did God totally cast the Jews off and say, I'm done with you guys? And Paul's answer to that is, God forbid. No. He did not turn his back on anybody totally without any provision for them to take care of the problem of sin in their lives. So then what he does is he reminds these, and of course, the 11th chapter of Romans is the end of his argument that started in chapter 1. Romans 12 through 16 is application of what he said in Romans 1 through 11. So he's at the end of his argument. He's been hammering on this for 11 chapters. And what his point is, goes back to Romans 1:16, the gospel is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. That be anybody that's not a Jew. It's the gospel. So his answer to them is, absolutely not. God didn't turn his back on the Jew. The Jew is, in fact, any Jew and every Jew that will ever be saved will be saved just like a Gentile. That is the thrust of Romans 11. How is a Gentile saved? By the gospel, Romans 1:16. By the gospel. So all Israel will be saved. So is an adverb of manner. It means in the same way as. So all Israel is going to be saved in the same way as the Gentile, which is by the gospel. By the gospel. So Romans 11:26 is not saying that every Jew on the planet is going to go to heaven and be forgiven of their sins. They can if they choose to obey the gospel. But the millennialist says, oh, all of Israel is going to be saved. Not the way they are explaining it. Okay? This is crucial. If you ever talk to a millennialist, I guarantee you, if you talk for very long, this is going to come up. So, are you comfortable in answering that? I guess that's a yes. It's the deer in the headlights. Well, you probably will, because you know, that's a judgment call. That's going to be based upon the knowledge of the person you're talking to. But I think you would absolutely need to remind them of what the argument in the book of Romans is about, and why the Jew is having such a difficult time with Paul's proposition. I mean, probably somebody could make a sermon out of this. But you could probably take the book of Romans and go through and come up with at least a half a dozen or more places where Paul says, in essence, you're accusing me of sin because I'm telling you you need the gospel. I know he does it in chapter 5. But it's alluded to several times. Wrong passage. Chapter 3, same. It's on the right-hand side of the right column, two-thirds of the way down. It's just one page earlier. Okay. Verse 8 of Romans 3. Why not, as we are slanderously reported, as some affirm, that we say, let us do evil that good may come? See, what Paul was being accused of was in effect saying, well, we're just going to do God a big favor, and we're going to let this gospel take care of this business, and in fact, that we're advocating sin. No way. As he said in the last part of verse 6, God forbid. You know, in chapter 6, he uses that expression again. Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? God forbid. And that's what he said over here in Romans chapter 11. So, yes, you're going to need to at least lay a little bit of groundwork. Because when somebody gets something locked into their mind, they've got their mind made up, they're not prone to want to be confused with the facts. Yeah. Remember the old thing on the wall? My mind is made up. Don't confuse me with the facts. So you're going to have to take your ice pick and chip away at that a little bit and get that barrier broken down. Any other question? Okay, good. Then when it gets to the final exam in the course, and I ask that question, I expect a good response, right? All right. Isaiah chapter 28, verse 16. I think most of you know this, but some may not. There are more messianic prophecies in the book of Isaiah, almost than all the rest of the Old Testament combined, but more than any other book, that's for sure. Isaiah 28, verse 16. Therefore says the Lord God, behold, I'm laying in Zion a stone, a tested stone, a costly cornerstone for the foundation, firmly placed. He who believes in it will not be disturbed. Now, cornerstone. Yeah, that's what and sometimes today, symbolically, you set the cornerstone, then you build a building based upon the cornerstone as a reference point. Now they've got GPSs and XYZs and all these other things that they use for reference points, but back then, they set that cornerstone exactly in an orientation so that then when they drew a line from this wall, I mean this surface, it went that way, and this one went that way, and they laid out their building by the cornerstone. It was a critical part of the building process. So also, God uses that imagery here in Isaiah to say he's laying a cornerstone. Well, so what? Big deal. Well, this is figurative language. Let's get to Ephesians chapter 2, verse 20. Tyler, you want to read that for us, please? The chief cornerstone. Ding. Light go off. I mean, you already knew that, but now you know it again. Huh? 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 5 and 6. Cameron?
Two.
Yes, sir.
You yourselves, like living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. For it stands in Scripture, "Behold, I am laying in Zion a stone, a cornerstone chosen and precious, and whoever believes in him will not be put to shame."
I mean, if we didn't know anything else in the Bible about this cornerstone other than this verse, we'd know it's a person. He who believes in him. Him who? Well, the cornerstone. The chief cornerstone. Now, as we just noted, this is Jesus. Jesus is, figuratively speaking, the chief cornerstone. So, I mean, I don't know what we're up to now. Maybe 20-ish. 20-ish prophecies that were made. And we've pointed our finger at the scripture in the New Testament that says this applies to Jesus. The first one we started out with Genesis 3, verse 15. And who wrote that? Moses did, which means it was about how long before Christ came? About 1,500 years. Now, we've looked at others. The ones, Isaiah would have, of course, been 700-ish years, depends on, you know, but round numbers. How in the world could these different men at these different points in time, hundreds and hundreds of years separated from each other, have said something that all pointed to the same individual that came at one point in history, and these are specific things that identify his person, his place of birth, etc., his father, and da 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 da. How could that happen? Lucky guess. It has to have come from God. That's why we say, and we were talking about this earlier in the car, that's why we can say, here is one way that you can prove that this has to be revealed to us by God. Men could not have done this. You know, they could not have made all of these predictions, hundreds and hundreds and sometimes over 1,000 years before it happened, and they're not broad generalities. Some are extremely specific. The place of his birth, his family, and et cetera, et cetera. So, said it before. We'll say it again. This is one of the most powerful arguments you can make for the inspiration of the Bible, as well as the confirmation of the identity of Christ. The question invariably arises, though, well, if it's so obvious, why doesn't everybody believe it? When people believe things, you usually see a mass response. I mean, we drove by Dairy Queen a while ago, and they've been advertising half price for celebration of their anniversary, and lo and behold, the place was packed. You know, people believed that they were going to get half price burgers and Dairy Queens. People respond to things that are believable. So why not believe the Bible? Why not believe that Jesus is the Messiah? That's right. They don't want to, do they?
Selfishness, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of different reasons. Bottom line is they don't want to. Yep.
But there's a lot of people that do believe that they do. And just in everyday conversation, everywhere you ever go, if you think about it, people will say something. And the first thing, if you just kind of look at them, they'll say, I swear to God. Or they'll say,
they like to invoke God's name, and usually without even thinking about it.
Exactly, but do they want you to believe in them because they said that way?
Mm-hmm.
They said it that way, so mm-hmm. they have to believe in some higher power. They just don't want to do the steps that it takes to live this life. But it's on TV, it's on commercials, it's everywhere.
That's right, Cameron. Mm-hmm.
Who have been convinced or otherwise taught that the evidence, the Bible, is something that must be taught to them by somebody with an education or a degree or et cetera, you name it. Whereas, so they are intimidated by it.
Mm-hmm. There are. I think so. Yeah. Kind of goes back to those Harris Post statistics a couple of weeks ago, but just kind of a short sleeve guesstimation. Would you say majority do or do not believe that the Bible really is God's Word? Mm-hmm. In this country.
Majority probably don't.
Yeah. Therein lies the problem. Biggest part of the problem is if you don't believe this is the Bible, then you might as well be reading Peterson's Bird Book or something, It doesn't really matter. And so that's why it's incumbent upon us to be able to help people to understand, here is why I believe this is the Bible. This is not just, my think-sos. No, here is some hard evidence that is irrefutable. And so that's why we're studying this, is to better equip us to help people to understand that our belief is based upon solid information. And a foundation. Now, we talked about the chief cornerstone, the passage from Isaiah chapter 28, verse 16. In the Roman Catholic Church, the rock that the church is built on is supposed to be who?
Peter.
But if you take your concordance, whatever device you use, whether it's electronic or it's old-fashioned way, and you look at all of the passages that have to do with rocks and cornerstones in reference to a person, it's consistently who?
Jesus.
1 Corinthians 3:11. For other foundation can no man lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. end of discussion. The foundation is Christ, and he's it, no other. So, that finishes page 51. Any question on that? Next group of prophecies. Now, what do you? Where did that come from?
It's been there a while.
It must be a ghost. I did. If I had eyes in the back of my head, I would know that. But I never was a school teacher. All right, prophecies pertaining to his mission and his ministry. Again, we're talking something that's very specific here. Some are kind of a little more specific than others, but this one is, he is going to be preceded by Elijah, quote unquote. Isaiah chapter 40, verses 3 and 4. Here we are in Isaiah again. I'm coming from the back. I'm working my way forward. Jim, Isaiah 40, verses 3 and 4, if you would, please.
The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill brought low. The crooked places shall be made straight, and the rough places smooth.
All right. Don't lose that thought, and then turn to the last book in the Old Testament. In fact, the last chapter in the last book of the Old Testament. Be Malachi chapter 4. Gene, could you read for that for us verses 5 and 6? These are the closing words of the Old Testament.
5 and 6.
Yes, ma'am.
Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse.
Elijah is coming. Now, what's significant about that in terms of the identity of this person? If when they heard the word Elijah, what would they be thinking?
A great prophet.
A great prophet?
Who's dead.
And has been for a long time. All right. So, how's that going to work? Well, let's look at the New Testament.
God, all things are possible.
Yeah, it's true. He could raise him from the dead. In fact, that was a thought that some people had, didn't they? Whenever Jesus asked them, "Who do you men say that I am?" Some say Elijah or Jeremiah or one of the prophets, Matthew chapter 16. Speaking to Matthew in chapter 17. Verses 11 and... Well, let's read 9 through 12. Mark, do you want to read that? Matthew 17, 9 through 12. Or 13. 9 through 13.
Now as they came down from the mountain, Jesus commanded them, saying, "Tell the vision to no one until the Son of Man is risen from the dead." And his disciples asked him, saying, "Why then do the scribes say that Elijah must come first?" Jesus answered and said to them, "Indeed, Elijah is coming first and will restore all things. But I say to you that Elijah has come already, and they did not know him, but did to him whatever they wished. Likewise, the Son of Man is also about to suffer at their hands." Then the disciples understood that he spoke to them of John the Baptist.
So here we have an inspired interpretation given by Jesus himself, that the Elijah that preceded him, quote unquote, the Elijah that was spoken of in the prophets, Isaiah, Malachi, was John the Baptist. So John the Baptist was a type of Elijah. That wasn't his name, he was like Elijah, though. So that was the Elijah that preceded Jesus. It was John the Baptist. In John chapter 1, Gospel of John chapter 1, Rick, 19 through 24, would you read that, please?
John 1, 19 to 34.
24.
And this is the witness of John. When the Jews sent him priests and Levites from Jerusalem to ask him, "Who are you?" And he confessed and did not deny, and he confessed, "I am not the Christ." And they asked him, "What then? Are you Elijah?" And he said, "I am not. Are you the prophet?" And he answered, "No." They said to him, "Who are you? So that we may give an answer to those who sent us. What do you say about yourself?" And he said, "I am the voice of one crying in the wilderness, 'Make straight the way of the Lord,' as Isaiah the prophet said." Now they had been sent from the Pharisees.
So, that's good enough. He quotes, "Make straight the way of the Lord," from Isaiah. And he applies it to himself, John the Baptist. Which is Jesus said, this Elijah, quote unquote, was John the Baptist. And here Elijah, here John the Baptist quotes the passage and says, this applies to me. He was not literally Elijah, but he was like Elijah. Coming to make the way of the Lord ready. He came to prepare the hearts of people for the coming of the Lord. Some accepted, some did not. Most did not. But anyway, that was his assignment, to make the way ready. Any question about that? Ed?
You kind of see in this passage and the other passage about how what they were looking for and what they've been taught and what their understanding was of the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
You see, they were looking for somebody.
They were. What else, especially in this passage, jumps out at us? There was I didn't know if anybody picked up on that.
Well, they asked him if he was the prophet.
Yeah, the prophet. The prophet. It goes all the way back to the citations of Deuteronomy. The prophet, end of Samuel, where God told David, and then of course in Deuteronomy, which is quoted in Acts chapter 3, applying it to Jesus, which we will be looking at that passage. But you're absolutely right. Yeah, Deuteronomy 18. I was trying to think of Deuteronomy 18. So yes, they were. I did a lot more reading today of some of the material that I've been acquiring. And they were really, 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 really looking for the Messiah. There was kind of ebbs and flows. There were times when, and this is pretty typical, there were times when things were not too bad. They were doing sort of okay, that there wasn't much said about the Messiah. But boy, when things got tough, then they really started talking about, okay, the Messiah is going to come, and which we know what they were looking for. They were looking for somebody to rescue them. All right. I already took that book back home. I was going to read something to you. That's on my desk. Okay. Psalm 40, verses 6, 7, and 8. Now, there are a number of messianic psalms, too. They're scattered hither, thither, and yon, but then in the largest book of the Bible, you would expect that. Scott, you can read that if you want.
Psalms 40, 6 through 8. In sacrifice and offering you have not delighted, but you have given me an open ear. Burnt offering and sin offering you have not required. Then I said, behold, I have come, in the scroll of the book it is written of me. I delight to do your will, O my God, your law is within my heart.
Can't you just see some old kind of narrow-minded Jew saying, you didn't want sacrifices and offerings? What are you talking about? What about Leviticus? What about Exodus? What about Deuteronomy? Now, this is one of the, you have to couple this with the Hebrews, the book of Hebrews. And, of course, this passage is quoted in Hebrews chapter 10. But if you can reflect upon our study of the book of Hebrews, you know that in this section of Hebrews, especially chapters 9 and 10, and 10:4 is the quintessential verse, the blood of bulls and goats does not take away sin. When he says, in whole burnt offerings and sacrifices, thou hadst no pleasure, what he's saying is, they did not effect a means of taking away sin. God did not accept animal sacrifices as the means for the removal of sin. It goes back to what we were saying about the first covenant. It was never, ever designed to do that. It was preparatory to the coming of Christ. And Hebrews 9 and verse 15 makes it clear that the only way that anybody will ever be forgiven, regardless of when they lived, is on the basis of the sacrifice of Christ, not an animal sacrifice. Now, that being the case, as the Hebrew writer continues his argument to show the superiority of the first covenant over the second, because that's what the second covenant was designed to do, was to provide for the forgiveness of sin. You can see then why this passage is applied to Christ. And in verse 9 of Hebrews chapter 10, where he said, lo, I am come to do thy will. Yes, that's what Jesus said about himself. I came to do my Father's will. What was that? Rest of verse 9 of Hebrews 10. He taketh away the first that he may establish the second, by which will we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. That is, one time for all time. He took away the first what to establish the second what?
Covenant.
Yes, covenant. Or a synonym for that is will. Paul argues those terms synonymously in Galatians chapter 3. But again, the Hebrew writer does the same thing, and it's quite possible that Paul was a Hebrew writer, but we don't know that for sure. But the Hebrew writer does the same thing that Paul did in Galatians and Romans. The law is not it. It never was the way. Never was anything other than the preparation for the coming of the new covenant in Christ. So, those, they call them Messianic Jews. That's the tag that's hung on them today. They say, yeah, okay, but still the main thing is the law, that first covenant. No, the main thing is not the first covenant. The first covenant was taken out of the way and nailed to the cross, according to Colossians 2, verse 14. That expression, nailed to the cross, in Colossians 2:14, there are a few of us in here that can remember the good old days when you got your canceled checks back from the bank and what had happened to them when they were processed. Now, you young people, you don't even have the foggiest notion what I'm talking about. Yeah, and what else? They had a bunch of holes punched in them, didn't they? They had been run through a machine that punched a bunch of holes in it to show that it had been processed and canceled. Colossians 2:14, he took it out of the way, nailing it to the cross. Whenever in their culture they posted something up for general information and it was a edict, you know, everybody stand up and salute, you know, whatever. Whenever that order or that post was no longer to be carried out, they canceled it. And guess how they canceled it? They poked holes in it. Jesus took it out of the way, nailing it, what? The first covenant. You read Colossians 2 and you see that. Now, he didn't literally take a copy of the law and go up here on the cross and say, okay, guys, would you nail this to my cross with me? No. He did it by fulfilling God's plan. He canceled the first covenant. It had fulfilled his purpose. Just like whenever, again, back in the olden days, we wrote somebody a check, sent it to them, they took it to their bank, you canceled it, it got processed, run through the federal system and back to your bank, and you got it back in an envelope, and you pull it, hey, okay, yeah, stamp, canceled, good, finished, it's through. It's a piece of paper now. That's all it is. So you can't go cash it again. Same way with the law. The old covenant was canceled, it was finished, it was over, it was history. And that's what the Jew was having so much trouble accepting. They just could not wrap their mind around the idea that God went to all that trouble just so he could say, okay, we're through with that now, let's move on. Read Galatians, read Romans, and read Hebrews, and you can't miss the point. And our time is up. Which means I better make a mark. He came to do the Father's will, and part of the will that he came to do was to take away that first covenant. So that, the rest of that verse in Hebrews chapter 10 is, he could establish the second. You go back to Hebrews chapter 8, which is there's a quotation from Jeremiah chapter 31 to say, where it says, I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel, not like the covenant that I made at Sinai, not kind, the kind that was written on tables of stone, but the kind that is written on the heart that provides for the forgiveness of sins, because the first covenant didn't. Okay. Any questions about that? Yeah.
When he says once for all,